Welcome to Churches Planting Churches, a podcast on the theology and practice of church planting. I'm your host, Tony Marita. Various parts of the world today have been labeled post-Christian. Many planters minister in areas that are hostile to the gospel, while others are ministering where people are happy without the gospel. The former faces the threat of physical persecution for preaching the gospel. The latter face other challenges like indifference, biblical cluelessness, secularism, perhaps mockery, ridicule, and even legal rulings that may affect Christians. In a post-Christian context, believers are tempted to retreat rather than engage the culture with the gospel. Often it's not because of the lack of opportunity, the lack of freedom, or the lack of training. It's for lack of courage. Fear within can keep all of us from living out the gospel in word and deed. So how can we boldly engage people with the gospel in the marketplaces, in the workplaces, in our neighborhoods, in recreation centers, in our networks? On today's podcast, we welcome Matt Chandler. Matt is the lead pastor of teaching at the Village Church in Flower Mound, Texas. He is also the president of Acts 29. Matt has recently written a book called Take Heart, in which he addresses the fears that grip our hearts in this age of unbelief. Matt says, quote, "I am convinced that if we have a God-sized, God-given courage, then we will be freed up to be the people of God, living out the mission of God, marked by the joy of God." Let's talk about courageous church planting.
Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, it's great to be here, Tony. I'm normally listening to you, so it's fun for me to actually be sitting across from you in this.
Yeah, I help you sleep at night, huh?
Well, they do. They do some nights better than others, but for sure.
Hey, I want to talk about courageous church planting, but before we do that, why don't you give us a brief update on you, Lauren, the kids, all as well?
Yeah, we're in a sweet season. You know, we've been married 20 years, so Lauren and I have kind of learned where the buttons are and how to avoid those buttons or how to more purposefully push those buttons, however you want to look at it. And we've got a high school daughter, middle school son, and a elementary school age daughter, but everybody can take their own shower. Everybody can make their own sandwich. Everyone can get themselves dressed. And so that becomes a pretty sweet season of life.
Mm-hmm. Amen. So tell us about Take Heart, new book, why you wrote it, and what's it about?
Well, so I was coming back from the Acts 29 European Conference in Rome, and I had walked through the ruins of the Colosseum, and that was a spiritual experience for me. To think that here, the greatest empire the world's ever known, I mean, ruled the world for 1,500 years from India to England. I mean, you start thinking about that in an American context, and that just kind of can blow your mind. 1,500 years. I mean, the U.S. is still in diapers, basically. And for 300 years, the Roman Empire sought to stomp out the Christian faith. And yet, here I was, a pastor from Dallas, Texas, you know, a place they didn't know existed when they ruled the quote-unquote world. And I've flown in a plane, and I've paid $20 to walk through one of their greatest achievements as a ruin. And I'm doing that in view of Maritime Prison, where they put Paul and where Peter was. And so it just struck me that the most powerful human umph is not going to ever stomp out the gospel. In fact, the harder you press, the more we flourish. In fact, if you want Christianity to be your undoing, you need only persecute it. And so I was coming back just with this heart full of excitement about really Revelation 7, and that we're on our way, and that God is accomplishing his purposes, and all that he promised Abraham in Genesis 12, we're seeing. I mean, what a privileged position in history. And then I come home, and there'd been some, you know, the bathroom stuff was going on at that point, and whether or not we should bake a cake for this kind of wedding, and what was legal and what was illegal. And I found a sense of panic among the people at the church that I pastored. And I just was like, no, let's not panic. Let's not. So Take Heart was really, it was really born out of that experience in Rome, and then coming back to the United States, where the church is feeling this loss of, either position or privilege, however you want to talk about that. And that was really the impetus of the book. And I want to just go, no, let's look up to the Lord. Let's consider that the Lord is a warrior. Let's consider that when all said and done, we win. And so let's be faithful and let's love well and let's show hospitality even to our enemies and let's watch the Lord work.
Mm. So you're talking a lot about culture, and I love in the book where you give some options, and Christians have historically either tried to convert culture,
yeah.
Condemn culture, or consume culture,
yeah.
You talk about, and you say that they're all born out of fear.
Yeah.
And I think that's on point, man. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, so anytime you're not doing what the Lord has commanded us to do, right? Which is salt and light, which is to be this picture of his goodness and grace. And that's not just Jesus's teaching. I mean, if you go all the way back to the garden, from the garden on, made in the image of God, given the cultural mandate to what? To reveal the beauty and majesty of God. And then you go to Exodus, and what do you see in Exodus? Right after Exodus 19, you will be for me a kingdom of priests. What does he give them? The law. So he positions his people right between the three biggest empires of the day and says, hey, show them that the way I've designed the world to work and what life submitted to me actually looks like. And then we see it again in Jesus's Sermon on the Mount. And then we see it again at the Ascension and the Great Commission. So this theme of being in the world, but not of the world, is really one of the great themes of the Bible. And so to operate in any of these other spaces is to kind of reject what God has called us into and to formulate our own way forward, which another theme of the Bible is that the people of God are prone to do this and then prone to kind of reap the devastation that causes when we say, no, we know how to engage this world more than you, our King and Heavenly Father, know how to engage this world. So that's what I was trying to get at. Hey, God's given us a path here. And according to the Bible, it's the path to life. And so let's live on this path and operate in this path and not be afraid of culture so much that we build up walls or that we just consume and try to pick and choose what's good and what's bad. But let's be the salt and light God's called us to be.
Mm, I love that. And I love how you're really addressing the heart in the book. It's not necessarily a strategy.
No.
More about, hey, it's okay to be on the margins of culture, not be the dominant yeah. voice. Remember who God is. You unpack kind of the warrior nature of God,
yeah.
which is just a wonderful drawing on, I think it's Longman,
yeah.
who and others who put that sort of the biblical theology
yeah.
running through the Bible. So the listeners want to pick up this book for sure and think through some of these heart issues. And then you get to the end of the book, and I love how you talk about hospitality as sort of a surprising
yeah.
Approach to engaging this culture with the gospel. Can you unpack the importance of hospitality a little bit?
Well, again, I love the idea of hospitality. It's something that God has woven into his plan for his people, that they're to be a hospitable people all the way back to the beginning. So this isn't a new idea, but maybe a lost concept. And I would probably say that there was a season in the life of the church where evangelism became kind of the primary, this is what we're going to be about, this is who we are, and I don't want to say no to that, I want to say amen to that, but I think in a context in which we're misunderstood and we're behind the eight ball from the first conversation, you know, we're bigots, we hate people, we're offensive by what we believe, I think that God knows where we were going to be operating, and so what he does is he says, okay, we'll just open up your dinner table and love and open up your home and encourage and speak life into and use your words in a powerfully prophetic way, not to denounce sin and sinners, but to love and encourage them to consider the Lord. Because I think in a real way, people who are stuck in their sins, and this is Paul arguing here, right? Romans 1, intuitively know something is wrong. And so if environments are created where they're loved and encouraged and the Christian faith is modeled for them, then I think that can overcome the hostility that presuppositional apologetics is not going to, right? And so we see that, and I'm not against presuppositional apologetics. I think you probably need some of those tools in your bag in 2018. But I've never seen them actually, unless it was a legitimate seeker, I've never seen those answers satisfy someone who's just shut down to the Christian faith. And you actually see this as Jesus answers the questions of the Pharisees, and they never consider when they get stumped by Jesus that he might actually be the Messiah. They just move on to the next question. They huddle up and think of another question so that they don't have to believe in him. And so anyone who's hardened to or hostile towards the gospel is probably going to take a page. My experience is they will take a page out of that playbook, and you'll answer their question only for them to go find another question, only for them to go find another question. And so I think the best thing we can do is practice hospitality, open up our dinner tables, and love well.
Mm-hmm. Amen. And to add to the resource list, if you're listening out there, I would also recommend A Meal with Jesus.
Oh, no doubt.
By our friends in England. And also Rosaria Butterfield's new book, The Gospel Comes with a House Key.
Yeah, I haven't got to read that yet, but I've heard amazing things.
So good, so good. And she is also addressing a little bit about the fact that we live in this post-Christian culture, yeah, and hospitality is an approach that's effective. We've got historical precedent.
No doubt.
So I just love the picture. I love the picture of the gospel that it portrays. I think about so many texts, especially in Luke. Luke talks so much about Jesus eating with people.
Yeah.
And Luke 15, right before the prodigal son narrative, there's the statement of this man receives sinners and eats with them.
Yeah.
You know, and
may it be said of us all.
Absolutely. And I don't know how you really do church planting well and faithfully without it. I was just talking to Matt before we started recording. One of our church planters who is in a very hard city told our interns recently that about 90% of the people present in the room, somewhere around 50 people, have first been in his house. And I just think it's crucial today that we learn the art of practicing hospitality. And as a church planter, we remember that this is, after all, a pastoral qualification.
Yeah.
So let's
which is stunning to think about, isn't it not? I mean, of all that list of things an elder had better be, practicing hospitality is on that list. Like, he had better live his life like this.
Yeah. And you've got another one that's somewhat related. He must be well thought of by outsiders,
yeah,
you know?
That's it.
So let's shift gears a bit and talk Acts 29.
Okay.
You took over as president.
Six
years ago.
Yep.
I don't want to talk much at all, really, unless you want to, about the early days.
Yeah.
I'd like for you to talk about the present and the future, Lord willing. What is it that excites you about Acts 29 right now?
So I think the two pieces that man really make me love this group of misfits is one is the global piece, the fact that God has given us favor. We're seeing a lot of favor in Africa and seeing a lot of favor pushing farther and farther east, where if I think back on our first European conference was in London, and then the second one was in Cardiff, Wales, and then we came back to London for the third one, and then pushed into Rome, and then finally this year's in Belgrade. And so, man, the Lord has just given us a lot of favor there. And then the second piece would be the diversity piece. Just love that more and more and more persons of color, men of color, are coming into the network and are finding leadership opportunities there. And when I think about our board and some of the key executive positions that are filled by persons of color, men of color in particular, it really is encouraging to me. Even if I think about life at the Village, where we're still fighting on some fronts that Acts 29 isn't fighting on. And so we've got the network director who's African, and then I look at our board, and our board is full of color. And so I'm eager for where that's taking us. So those are the two areas in particular. But I could keep going. I think assessment's better than it's ever been. I think training is better than it's ever been. I love the residency programs that are embedded into our churches. And even as a large church that plants, that certainly helps us. Whereas I think if somebody comes and like we've got four plants coming out in the next 18 months from the Village. And if I think about those guys, there are certain things that the Village has been able to teach them a lot about, but there are certain things they're just going to need to go experience somewhere else. Like, there's nobody setting up chairs at the Village. You know, there's no pastor setting up chairs at the Village. There's no, so to learn and to know what it's like to set up in a school, to set up. We need these residencies that are in other churches, and to send our guys to go and do 6 months, 3 months, in one case over a year, 2 years at another location, has been really a part of what it means to be this family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And over 700 churches now.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
What do you think about these numbers, man? What do you see in the future?
What I certainly appreciate about the numbers is they're real numbers. When I became president, what we learned is that, you know, there'd be eight churches saying, hey, we're planting a church, but that would come across in our numbers as there were eight planters going out. Really, it was one planter that eight churches were helping, you know, get established. And so those are 700 real churches in real locations on the ground getting it. And so I'm really encouraged by that. I think in the next few, we'll cross that 1,000 church threshold. And then, man, I don't even know what to think about it at that point. That's stunning to be 6 continents, 23 languages, 700 churches. It's bigger than I thought it would ever be.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a couple of other things I would just note quickly for those who may not be up on A29. One of the things that I love about our A29 family is the leadership. Our leaders are pastors.
Yeah.
Yourself, Steve. That's not to knock any other movement or whatever, but I just know that when I'm talking to our leadership in A29, they have the struggles of any local church pastor. And so I think that's very important for a number of reasons. And then, as you mentioned, the global piece is just thrilling.
Yeah, it really is.
To know that we're not an American network with a few friends overseas,
no.
But we really are a global family that's growing around the world, trying to train and equip people around the world. The Crosslands Theological Academy.
Yeah, another great initiative that's taken off. Church in Hard Places. I mean, we could just keep going. It's a fun time to be in the network.
Hey, talk about church planting as a big church pastor. I know a lot of guys, well, I don't want to say that. Talk to us about the challenges of sending people out of the village.
Yeah.
I can imagine some people they really like Matt Chandler at the village. And when you tell them, hey, why don't you go somewhere else and be part of this team?
Sure.
And I know you guys are in this process now of rolling out some of the campuses into autonomous churches or something like that. I'd love for you to chat about that too.
Yeah, so there's two ways we're looking at. One, we looked at our foray into multi-site, which when all said and done is going to be about a 10, 12 year kind of practice. We'll be rolling off all of those to be autonomous churches. We've already done one up in Denton and it's done incredibly well. In fact, we kind of braced for the whole Matt Chandler coming back home thing and it didn't happen, which I think we got 12 people back from that roll off. So my feelings aren't hurt by that. I was actually really encouraged. Part of what I'm hoping, and let's let it shake out. And if it shakes out, I've got a theory that we'll have some data that's true. I think that people will in time prefer localized, highly contextual ministry and preaching more than kind of the gifted preacher down the street. I think we're moving towards a place specifically in the United States where the guy on the stage that is really, really good isn't going to be the thing that sustains you, but actually being known and being embedded in a community where you are known and are missed and are, is going to become the thing that kind of keeps you. And when we rolled off the Denton campus, when we rolled off a campus that was 2,000 something people, and we really did brace and thought, okay, here comes the Matt Chandler effect. You know, these baby Christians or kind of consumers, they're going to flood back into our campus in Flower Mound where I preach live. And man, it just did not happen. So seeing that made me think, okay, what is that? And so then just to go up there and see that and have conversations with Bo Hughes, who's the pastor up there, there's something about, no, we are here in Denton, for the city of Denton. We're known in Denton. We love the people of Denton, the quirkiness of Denton, and we're gonna stay here. And so if we experience that across the other campuses, I'll be really to say, hey, here's been our experience in the buckle of the Bible Belt, that what is best for people, what ultimately hooks people to a local church is not necessarily dynamic preaching, but on the ground, in the trenches, on mission, in a given context, is the thing that really has made people go, no, this is home. And so again, I'm eager to let this thing keep rolling forward to see if that's right. I'm praying that it is. And then the second thing we've done, and this kind of is more about is something that, you alluded to, which we would just call golden handcuffs. Like the Village is by and large a very healthy church, and I think we pay well, and we've got great benefits, and so a lot of guys who God's probably got a call in their life will get comfortable with us in a way that we don't want them getting comfortable with us. So for us, both from the pulpit with our people and to our pastors who are just going to be with us for 4 or 5 years while we do some training and then roll them out, is to just talk about these kind of things all the time. That and you can do that subversively, or you can do that just kind of right, you know, here it is, you know, plain as day. So we talk a lot about like no one is going to be talking about the Village in Glory. No one will. Like there's not going to be anybody in there just mentioning anything about the Village, but they are going to be talking about the kingdom. And they're going to be talking about what the Lord did through broken people and the things that the Lord accomplished. And so we're just kind of perpetually get in front of our staff as well as our people that they've been called to something greater than consumption. And by and large, they bought it. In fact, we have a church plant going out in about 18 months. And this is our people have really bought in. In fact, some of the people that are going with them, I was like, no, not them. Don't let them go. You know, they're a vibrant, you know, pretty big part of what we're doing here. And they've just been willing to go. And this is a church plant that we're planting about 15 minutes from us. And so it's easier for them to go versus, you know, there we've got a guy heading to California and then another guy going to East Dallas, which is 45 minutes from us. And then another guy going to Richardson. And I think he'll take quite a few with him. So our people have rallied around this and they've gone out. And some of them, you know, when we planted a guy in DC, we had families move to DC and we planted down in College Station and we had a ton of people go down to College Station. So they, I've been extremely pleased with the people of the Village, their zeal to be a part of something bigger than just the Village. And we oftentimes talk about what God's done at the Village as maybe not being the big thing, but the big thing's actually later, maybe even when we're not here anymore. And then, man, I've said this to our elders, and that like when it's my time to just kind of close my eyes and go home to be with the Lord, being worried about who's going to step into this kind of mega giga church and make it keep going. I don't want that to be on my mind, but to think that we have in our run planted hundreds and hundreds of gospel preaching, biblically serious, missional, spirit-filled churches, man, that's just a great use of a 20, 30 year run. Now, the size of the Village creates an engine that can help do a lot more than if we were smaller. So I've never, I haven't in a long time begrudged the size of the Village, even though in my own heart it becomes a lot harder for me personally to practice hospitality when there's, you know, 12,000-15,000 people. But that engine really has helped produce, at this point, great, great, great granddaughter churches, which is fun for us. Anyway, so that's some of what it's like at a big church.
I love it, man. I love what you're doing. I admire your leadership many reasons. Now let's talk for a minute about young church planters listening to this podcast. What are two or three kind of topics you regularly hit? You would want a young church planter to think about, not forget, as he sets out to plant a church.
Yeah. So my experience with church planters is they have a strength that makes them lean in one of two directions. The first direction is a guy, and this is a total overgeneralization, so let me start by saying that a guy that's going to really lean towards the pragmatic. He's got his plan. He knows what he's going to do the first 6 months. He knows what he's going to do the first 12 months. He knows where he's going to be at 18 months. But he kind of lacks some of the more kind of spiritual sides of things. Not that those things, planning isn't spiritual. I mean, I could certainly look at Nehemiah and go, no, he had a plan. I mean, he spent 40 days fasting and praying, but he had a plan. But these are guys that have studied well enough and done enough kind of residencies and things like that, that they really know what to do. And they've learned from the guys that have done really well at it, but probably haven't prayer walked the neighborhood a lot and haven't really asked for the power of God to be present in a unique way. And and then you've got the other side, the guy that has just prayer walked and man, he's prayed up and he's zealous and he's eager, but he has no idea what he's going to be doing 6 months in or 12 months in or where they're going to meet after this or where. So, So, man, depending on who I was sitting in front of, those are conversations I'd want to have, that planning's a good thing. But planning is just like putting the sails up in your sailboat, right? Now you need the wind to blow. Or hey, bro, the wind's blowing, but you ain't got no sails. And so those are the kind of conversations I find myself in often with church planners. They have a tendency to lean in one of those directions and forget their desperate need for the other. Mm. And God's designed that they have both. Mm. So that's a conversation. I think more and more, I'm convinced that brothers need to have a level of theological education sometimes that they lack. That's why I love the Crosslands Initiative. That's why I love some of the residencies that are in-house now that are more theologically bent, not finishing schools, but man, let's dive into some theological things before we move into kind of a finishing school. So I think there's an assumption that some of the brothers have strong enough theology to carry them through 30 years of ministry, and I just don't know that that's the case. And so those would be kind of the top three, I think, in my head.
Excellent. So we're talking about guys who are planting churches, but one of the things that I know you appreciate about A29 now is our, maybe we can call it a new complementarianism, of our approach to making sure women are viewed rightly, valued, trained, deployed as participants in the church plant. For the ladies who are out there listening, any encouragement you would give them about church planting?
Yeah, so I'll just say it and then I'll just take the push from it. I think if you're a part of a church plant where your gifts aren't valued and where you're not invited to participate in the life of the body, that's an unhealthy place that's only going to grow more toxic over time. It's not going to grow less toxic. And so I would just really think about whether or not that's where you want to embed, and that's where you want to, like there's a call on the man to make sure that the woman is flourishing, and to create spaces for her to flourish. And any type of organization that would have them left out of, and I'm not talking about kind of that hardcore, crazy egalitarian argument that I've heard where, man, if she's not an elder and she's not preaching on the weekend, she's been silenced. I mean, that's so reductionistic. But I'm saying where are women theologically trained in the church? Where are their gifts identified, and where are they deployed in the mission? And I think church planners need to be thinking about that. And I think women, it's not unreasonable or unbiblical for women to expect that from their churches. Mm. Because that's what complementarianism is, right? It's not that male headship, it's complementarianism. We're saying that for us to be what God's called us to be, there's these complementary roles that we each play. So to say that it's just male headship, that then makes us look like something other than what God designed us to look like. So that's what I would say to the ladies, that you should expect and encourage and ask for places where there's theological education and there is gift identification, and then there is mobilization for that gift. And that's how we've thought about it at TBC, and that's how I'm hoping we will more and more and more think about it in Acts 29.
Love it, man. Last question, practical question. You're obviously a guy with a lot going on, family and so on. How do you rest? What do you do for fun? How do you make sure you're not just grinding all the time?
And so there's several things, and some of these have been woven into my life for years, and some of them are kind of newer. So the things I've done for years is, I guard my day off. That day is Friday, and we are not, you are not email. I will not open my computer. I have at times not turned on my phone on Fridays, and so that's just a lockdown. I'm not available, right? And so now we've had moments where, like we had a moment where a key leader in our church was killed in a tragic accident. So I'm not talking about that, you know. We had plenty of pastors at the hospital when I finally got there. I'm certainly available for that. But man, if a member of the congregation is really stressed out about this issue or that issue, I mean, they're going to be stressed out about that when I'm back online Saturday. Protected the Friday. Once a month, I do a full day. On my calendar, it will just say the day. It's me, my Bible, and my journal, and no devices, and we're going to go get somewhere. Sometimes I'll drive about an hour outside of Dallas, where a friend of mine, member of our church, has a ranch. And man, I'll just walk the grounds of that ranch. I'll get up early, sit in the blind and watch the animals come out to feed. And that's just my day. I just want to be with the Lord. So I fast that day, seek his face. I'm hungry to be with him in that way. I've added some rule of life rhythm to my everyday where I want to look for transitions and stop in those transitions and reorient my heart. And then the Village Church graciously every 7 years gives me a pretty good sized sabbatical. And what's crazy is they've gotten more and more aggressive about that sabbatical as I've been at the church longer. So my next sabbatical is next summer. And the elders have like, you're not allowed to go anywhere where you're Matt Chandler. So you couldn't go, even if you weren't speaking at a conference, you're not allowed to go to those spaces, right? So you're going to take this chunk of time. You're going to be with the Lord. You're going to be with your family. You're going to rest. We want you to drop the plan around that. And that's been a real blessing for me. So those are some of the things.
Man, this has been so enlightening, so edifying, so helpful. Thanks so much, man, for taking time to be on the podcast.
I love it. Thanks for all you do for it.
Oh, thanks, man. Listeners, you want to pick up Matt's book along with David Roark called Take Heart. And Matt, thanks again. Take care.
No, for sure.